everyone, and welcome to the Game Developer Podcast. This is episode 39, and we are going to be focused on the 2024 GDC State of the Game Industry Survey Report. And today, I am joined by my colleagues Bryant Francis from Game Developer and Dom Tate and Liam Dean from our sister organization, Omdia. So we are, like I said, going to discuss the 2024 State of the Game Industry Survey Report, which surveyed over 3,000 game developers about topics that are important to game developers, like layoffs in the industry, game engines and game engine changes, generative AI, monetization, unionization, and much, much more. This is the second year GDC has partnered with Game Developer to produce the report. And this year, for the first time, we partnered with Omdia to produce the report, which is why we have our good friends from Omdia here. Folks, would you like to introduce yourselves?
I'll go first, just since I was called in first. Hello, my name is Brian Francis. I am a senior editor at GameDeveloper.com. And my favorite game I'm playing right now is Against the Storm. And that's my little fun fact I'll drop in here to get us started.
That's very good.
And my name is Dom Tate. I'm research director of the games team at Omdia, which produces data and analysis on the games industry. I have been playing Zelda since May. I am sizing Excellent. Up Bramble the Mountain King as my next move.
Hey, my name is Liam Dean. I'm now on the games team at Omdia, looking at more kind of the tech B2B side of the industry. And I am playing Persona 5, which is the first time I've ever played a Persona game, which is quite an experience.
That's fantastic. Good one to kind of start with, I think. That's one everybody loves. At least that's what my perception is. I watched someone play 100 hours of it. I didn't play it myself, but I heard that song so many times that it's in my brain. It's fully lodged in there.
There are some songs well and truly lodged in the brain. Yeah, I think I'm like 30 hours in, they're still introducing new mechanics. It's quite a thing.
Well, if anybody wanted to know, I am still playing Into the Breach 5 years
of
later.
Course.
6 years later?
Of course.
6 years later, I think. So that's where I'm at. That's my perennial answer. And it's true. I'm you know, not making it up. It's real.
You're always headed into the breach.
That's where I live. You know, I live Into the Breach. So that's where we're always at. Awesome. Well, anyway, other than, I suppose, the breaches, we're here to talk, of course, about the State of the Industry report. And we have a couple of topics we wanted to just generally discuss with our good folks here. Number one was the sort of monetization methods and any particular changes that had happened with those. I want to let our Omdia folks chat about those a little bit here. So either of y'all, if you want to jump in and talk about what you noticed in the report and how you did sort of the analysis there.
Well, yeah, there's certainly one interesting element, which is so 51% of people are choosing digital premium games for the current game that they're developing. And what's nice about that is that it keys into something that we believe happened in 2023, where the value of digital full game purchases for the first time exceeded that of physical. So that was quite a nice tie-in with data that we're seeing within the kind of consumer game spend aspect of the industry.
Yeah, and the other thing that jumps out is just the sheer diversity. I mean, you know, there's no single dominant business model anymore. It's just spread across so many different approaches. And, you know, maybe within individual niches and platforms, you still have your narrative AAA console games. Those are your big $70 heavy hitters. You have other models that might, you know, dominate in the hyper-casual sector, but kind of zooming out, look at the industry as a whole, what you see is that, it's more defined by variety and diversity than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, in other parts of my job, I look at different areas of entertainment, and I always feel like music and video would kill for this variety of monetization methods that games have. And I know that games are quite slow to subscription services in terms of, you know, Netflix and Spotify having been around for quite a while, but it almost feels like music and video could learn from games in terms of subscription services rather than the other way around, just because of that variety of monetization methods that games have got.
Please go for it, Brent.
It's not a podcast if someone doesn't try to talk over each other. I was going to say, first off, Liam alluded to something interesting there, which is, you know, $70 AAA games, the climbing price, you know, of AAA games last year. I believe I'm blanking out if it was rejumped from $69.99 USD to $79.99, or if it was just a jump to, I don't know. But we did see, you know, that $10 price increase on big AAA games begin to enter the industry last year. And so that's going to have, you know, the subtle, either we'll have a so subtle a shift it doesn't notice because general, like, increase of the value of the dollar and what we would generally refer to as inflation, but not the super inflation of last year, has just meant that the price needed to go up to match, you know, the power of the dollar. Or anyway, that's one thing that Liam alluded to that I think is going to shape the future of this most popular segment. And something else that occurred to me while I looked at this graph was that digital premium games make up so many of what our survey, so many of our survey respondents are working on digital premium games, but the biggest revenue generators in the industry are free to download games with in-app monetization. This might be, it kind of speaks to me that like that space, it's this graph being kind of an inverse of how much those money, those two ends of the business actually bring in, kind of reflects how mobile free-to-play or free-to-play in general is calcifying into these, you know, very big heavy hitters. And in 2023, we saw a lot of live service games launch and then shut down right away just because it's so hard to break into the space. But you can't ignore the revenue from that section because it seems much more profitable and stable than taking gambles on premium game releases. So did you know making and selling games is really hard? That's what I took away from that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And there is a bit of a disconnect there. So yeah, we have over half here saying digital premium games. I think if you look at kind of from the most macro possible view at market revenue, the overall games market revenue, only about 20% now is coming from that kind of upfront, you pay your $60, $70 and get your game. So it's already shifted a long way away from that. But I think what that might be reflecting to some extent is that those games, they are so labor intensive. There are a lot of developers working on making those games. But yeah, I mean, it depends a lot what your level of abstraction is when you're looking at it, though, because I mean, the overall revenue in the mobile sector from free-to-play games is really big and relatively stable. But at the level of individual games, individual developers and publishers, is incredibly volatile. Like even way more so than the traditional sector. So it's that's created this tension, obviously, where there's so much pressure to tap into that revenue, but it's kind of less understood, like what the recipe is for getting a slice of that pie than for the kind of the traditional market.
I think some context I think is interesting around that is you mentioned, you know, these premium games only occupying, you know, 20% of the game revenue. Well, everyone loves to throw around how the video game industry is, you know, this industry that's worth more than Hollywood, or it's worth more than Hollywood because so much of that revenue is generated from free-to-play, especially mobile free-to-play. So when you say like premium games are, you know, are a smaller chunk of the pie, well, thankfully, it's a big pie, like that, or that pie is really big, which is what makes that number look small. And so, within that slice of that delicious slice of the pie, I'm not allowed to call it a healthy business with all the layoffs happening right now, but it's a business that I really love, and I don't think we should short sell, you know, the folks who are working hard in this end of the business because they are truly trying to make things that can break out and like really capture the attention of the world. So I think it's interesting that the numbers that can look bad are also a representation of like this is what makes this is what attracts people to the game industry, even if mobile games we all forget about are the ones that bring in that headline generating revenue.
My sense as not a business person, but just a person who obviously reports on and looks at all the numbers and looks at all the games, is that there are even fewer bigger heavy hitters in that space than the massive AAA, you know, the sort of the titles that get, I always think of like, okay, if I see it in the subway station or if I see it on the bus stop, that must be like, oh, that was like a big AAA marketing push kind of thing. So yeah, and I actually don't know if I'm right about that. It's just sort of my sense that there are very few, but very massive, you know, the Fortnites or the mobile games that are truly, truly massive free-to-play games versus, okay, God of War, you know,
yeah.
The last of it Us is, part it,
It is crazy that, I mean, like weirdly on advertising is that it is crazy to me. It's bonkers to me that when you're talking about Subway ads, you know, there was a point where I feel like even a game like Dante's Inferno from EA, like back in 2011 or so, probably had Subway ads, like that tier of game. Like, oh yeah, it's a AAA release, but you know, it only cost like, I don't know how much, I forget how much games cost back then, but like we wouldn't necessarily think of, you know, this little like third person, you know, like this action kind of brawler thing that today would kind of get like a super, if it did well, it would do well like in this kind of niche level on Steam. But that was getting Subway ads, and today Candy Crush gets the Subway ads. Yep. So thoughts for your thoughts, everyone.
I mean, even in the AAA space, I think, you know, the question of is Roblox and Fortnite, are they going to, you know, stop people from playing our premium games? That's definitely exercising top publishers at the moment. You know, they are definitely concerned at the 70 million daily active users on Roblox, for example. That's just a massive figure.
I'm not. I'm personally not. Why be concerned? Me? Worry? Why worry? I don't know.
It's the generational worry as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Look at the demographic mix of the Roblox players. That's, you know, you don't worry because you don't want to play Roblox, and why would you? But lots of kids do. And, you know, the worry is that they're going to age up with that platform, and Roblox will find enough diversions to make them happy within that platform. And they've now got kind of mature experiences. And it's, I think it's a definite concern for AAA publishers that they're just going to be wrapped within that ecosystem and never leave it.
I make it a conscious effort to never put myself in a position where I worry about like, oh no, the youths are into this. Like, what does that mean for my life and my business? That's not a commentary on how you guys operate. This is how I try to live my life. Why worry about the youths?
You have the skateboard. You know, you're just kind of like, fellow kids, I'm fine. saying you're the opposite. I understand. I just liked the image of you with the skateboard and the hello, fellow kids. I just liked it. It was a good image. Made me happy.
All the accurate because I never learned how to skateboard. One time I tried and I fell flat on my head. Before we move out of monetization, I think I want to like point to something. It tickles me. Which is that blockchain driven monetization is a, look at that little tiny 3% number down there.
It's very small.
And we did see elsewhere in the survey that only 17% of developers said their developers were somewhat or very interested in using blockchain technology this year for their games, down from 27% in 2023. That question's a little broader because it's not just currency. You know, you can obviously use like NFTs. In theory, you can use NFTs and some other blockchain mechanics for things that aren't just monetization, but they are the pitch we got in the last couple of years with it. This is how games are going to be. You're going to be selling your items after you're done with them. You're going to make things in a game and sell and make money. And look at that. Look at that little 3% number. I'm not convinced that that's the future.
Yeah, I mean, just from the perspective of what we do, like market revenue tracking, this never happened. Like Web3 gaming, you know, a few games existed, but it never moved the needle even slightly, even at the peak of the boom. So, I mean, 3% in a way strikes me as a big number, because you have to put quite a lot of zeros in front of that before you get to the percentage of the actual market that those games make up.
Yeah. You've got, at best, a few companies in South Korea are kind of slightly interested in this and that. And I think even that interest is becoming dimmed as they see that where the market's going.
I'll use my soapbox to close on the blockchain thing, which is that something that fundamentally bothered me about the model was that it kind of, if it wasn't gambling, then it was at least like turning play into work. Like the idea that you had to like either you were doing this because you were hoping like you would make the NFT that could sell for like $1 million, or you were doing this because it's the only way to feed your family, as we saw briefly with
one. Crypto Kitties or something like that.
Oh god,
I know what you mean.
It's Axie Infinity.
Axie Infinity. Thank you, Leon.
Yeah.
Weird cute creatures that, like, you know, everyone's like literally like they're subleasing creatures from other rich people to play them to earn money just because of this weird like moment where the, you know, the local currency was worth less than the cryptocurrency, and it's weird. I don't like that. It's exploitative. We're video games. Let's never wander over there. Let's not do it.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, that was just the core of the problem as well. Even if you have no concern except for trying to make money. It's not even good at that. It never really made any money except for some speculation, which is because all the mechanics, as you say, they only are interesting from the perspective of gambling or investment or how you want to look at it. There's just never any evidence that there's a market of people out there who want to play these games.
I think with NFTs in particular, and this is a broader point, it was almost an answer to a question no one was asking. And I think that's still the problem with it. If you consider it a problem, where I think, Brian, you just consider it something that you're glad is going away. And that's, you know, perfectly reasonable too. But, you know, that's the state of the market at the moment.
That makes perfect sense. From what I suppose we're going from one potentially grim thought to another here. I purposely sort of sandwiched in this particular topic between some other stuff, but I do think we need to talk about the layoffs piece of state of the industry. There were some rather difficult, rather challenging numbers in here. I'm a little bit too familiar with them because I actually wrote this section and then wrote a piece about it the other day. So it was a 7 or 9%, I believe, of developers said they were laid off specifically, and almost a third, it was actually 35%, were affected by a layoff. We use the language of affected by because either their direct colleagues were laid off or someone else in their studio was laid off. And we also did some specific analysis there in how that was different, perhaps unsurprisingly, perhaps a little bit cynically, depending on departments, depending on where you work, sort of in a game studio. QA was the hardest hit at 22%, and business and finance was the least hard hit at 2%, which was a statistic that certainly I raised my eyebrows at that. Want to open the floor for other folks to sort of chat about this piece, which, again, to me is one of the most sort of eye-opening portions of SODI this year.
I'm happy to go on that. I mean, there was some of the vox pops that you asked the developers inside, you know, those who wanted to add their comments. And one person just kind of summarized it almost, not almost perfectly, but very close to perfectly in 7 words, which is studios grew too quickly during the pandemic. And, you know, if you look at the consumer revenue over 2020 and 2021, you get this kind of little camel hump of revenue, about 50 billion of kind of unexpected revenue that the games industry made during COVID. And when companies see kind of 2 years of, you know, a new trend, they just tend to think that's how it's going to be. You know, it's the continuation of observable trends. And it's not just limited to the game industry. Loads of industries do it. So I think what we're seeing at the moment is a correction to a new, less exciting, but still decent consumer trend line in terms of increasing spend. But it's just not one which lots of companies had geared themselves up to expect. And so there's quite a lot of pain at the moment. But I mean, like, I think the fundamentals to 2027, 2028 look decent, look like there's kind of sustainable growth there, with one big unknown of generative AI, which I know Liam can sort of, you know, talk your hind legs off on.
Please.
But before, yeah, well, I'm sure we'll get to that. Don't worry.
I can spiral off. We got to save that for later.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think what Dom said is absolutely right. I mean, you know, it seems obvious in hindsight that you look back and think, okay, we had this COVID bump. It was a one-time thing. But, you know, we didn't know that at the time. There was a theory of the case that was, okay, there are so many people that they're getting into games or maybe rediscovering a lot of games during the pandemic, and they're going to convert into long-term consumers, and we'll just have a permanently bigger, faster-growing market after this. Not really the way it worked out. I think most people who played more games during the pandemic just went back to what they were doing before when things went more back to normal. So, like, that's a painful adjustment to make. I mean, it's just the nature of the games industry that kind of we work on long timelines, multi-year timelines, and it might be that, you know, we're kind of already kind of getting back into kind of a reasonable growth trend at the overall industry level. But there are so many individual companies that have spent so much money on the assumptions of growth that hasn't quite materialized. It might still be another painful year ahead before we kind of get to a point where everyone can feel a little bit more comfortable with where their investments are lined up with kind of what the market is actually bringing in.
Yeah. My thoughts on it, you probably caught me doing a little at how QA, you know, was the hardest hit and business and finance was the least hit. I should generously say, you know, there's probably more QA folks in the industry than business and finance people in the industry. So like, especially responding to this survey, like that just may be one of the core factors there. But interesting. The people who made the decisions that led to the QA workers offer getting laid off are fine, but the QA workers are not fine. I've been trying to wrangle with, you know, on the reporting side, like what it means that, as Liam and Dom pointed out, that, you know, like this is a partly, if not mostly or partly, I don't know which one it is, but whichever, like, you know, this idea of it being an industry course correction from the pandemic, which also means that, you know, what we're dealing with right now with this layoff situation is this is sort of unprecedented. In the 2008 financial crisis, people have pointed out that while big companies, you know, AAA studios may have taken a hit, like casual gaming, Facebook gaming, mobile gaming all opened up. So your Zyngas, your Kings could, your Rovios could kind of like begin to play in the space. And there was kind of a release valve for layoffs and then hiring for anything. So it's kind of obscured. Going back to the Atari crash, like of that almost, you know, people say it almost killed the game industry. Like, I guess we could have assumed at some point something would have replaced it if it wasn't Nintendo and Sega. That was like so dramatic and so like built on the economics of, you know, all this physical hardware stuff that, okay, that's not happening again. So what's going on right now is it's unprecedented. I don't want to use that in a big, like the word unprecedented can be used to describe a lot of scary things right now. And this is scary, but not as scary as, like, I don't know, the fact that Boston's winter has been so mild in the last couple of years. Let's not dwell too long there, but like, if nothing else, like, I think what's scariest for game developers is that because it's unprecedented, because we've never had to deal with like a market correction like this, or what would the Omdia folks here have described as a market correction, like people just don't know how to respond, people don't know if they'll have work. And so the emotions that come with that are pretty strong. Something I'm not going to qualify my statements. I'm going to quickly shuffle over to the fact that there's another kind of chicken coming home to roost, though, which is that a lot of game studios that overhire, like there's the overhiring problem, and there's also there's kind of the ballooning scope problem. I believe, you know, we, thanks to Microsoft and its weird filing errors, we learned, you know, the prices, the costs of these, you know, these Sony first party games like the Horizon series that are just astronomically huge. And those are scaling up without seeing corresponding scales in revenue. How is that profit being spent, or how is that revenue being, like, how are we, those costs being assumed? Who is deciding to assume those costs? Like, are those people close to development? Like, are good questions that are worthy of this moment. Like, how did we get so big? And something that I've kind of watched, something I think is relevant to the moment but doesn't get talked about as much, was when Epic Games did its layoffs last year, where it focused on like non-tech roles to maintain Unreal Engine and Fortnite. Tim Sweeney goes on stage and he says, oh, Fortnite's making less money from its classic, you know, like monetization methods, and it's finally starting to earn money on the UGC, the developer, like the Fortnite Islands method, but it's making less revenue from that because it has to pay out the developers a cut. And it's kind of like, well, wait, why isn't Fortnite making money? I thought this was the biggest thing in the world. I thought this was the metaverse. I thought this thing was going to, like, I thought Ariana Grande, Solid Snake, and Master Chief all doing fun dances together was going to be, you know, was going to be the infinite money machine forever. And what worries me about Fortnite and other big games is there are things in these games that, like, are becoming unsustainable and not the normal ways we use the word unsustainable. Like, there's games that I love that I'm like, wait, how are you going to keep updating? Why have your updates slowed down? Like, is this going to keep driving revenue? Like, should you start transitioning to a new game? So I think that's a relevant part of it, too, is that some of these, you know, there's decisions that were made not just about infinite money from consumers from the pandemic, but it go even further back to, like, 2017, 2018. And there's decisions about infinite, you know, the infinite game, the magical infinite game that are coming back in a bad way.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that from our Omdia folks?
There was quite a lot to cover. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, I think Fortnite's most recent play is to kind of do this Rocket League type game, and it's Minecraft type game.
So, and the Lego game they did, which was really cool.
The Lego one, yeah. I mean, that seems pretty smart to me. It seems like it's kind of plotting for a long-term play, which seems like it could do really well, possibly even at the expense of Minecraft. So I don't know. I'm not sure I share the kind of full negativity that you have about it, Brian. But yeah, I can understand why it might not be very kind of pleasing as somebody who kind of loves games, might not enjoy what's happening before.
Danielle, I think, were we going to talk about conglomeration and how people feel about conglomeration in the game industry?
I think we can go there. We were also going to talk about engines, but I know we are really sort of pressed for time at this point. But I think really naturally what we were just talking about segues so nicely into conglomeration that perhaps we have a few moments to talk about that here and sort of the sentiment about that, which was quite negative. Developers overall, in terms of the numbers, were not all that jazzed, perhaps, about massive conglomeration and the big things getting bigger. And of course, the unsustainability that we are chatting about right here. So opening the floor back up.
I helped write this section, so I'm going to take a big point, which is I don't have the year-over-year percentages right in front of me, but wow, game developers, like, we're pretty ambivalent a lot this year. And this year they're like, screw this. I do not like conglomeration. Yeah. By the time the survey was being taken, Embracer had loudly announced that it had made a very bad financial decision and it was starting to close down studios. So that was already happening. Microsoft was wrapping up the acquisition of Activision Blizzard. And I think a year of like jockeying with regulators kind of woke up a lot of people to the potential of what that acquisition could mean for like state of competition in the industry. And some of the like the sentiments in the survey we saw range from positive to negative. Some people thought like this would open a door for like other studios to squeeze in, you know, but other people were worried about how it would not. Like, how can you compete when the platform you're operating, like the platform you're operating on is also selling Call of Duty to people? And yeah, I think just everyone's more aware that like this is kind of what economists have talked about for a century, which is when monopolies, or more accurately oligopolies, begin to form. Is like, you know, it's the same reason your internet provider in the United States can basically tell you to pound sand if you don't like the fact that they won't, you know, give you a good service for your rate.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that there's so many different things going on here, because like the dynamics around the Activision Blizzard acquisition are really different to what was happening at Embracer. I mean, for obviously the Embracer thing really hung over this. And the good news for the large majority of developers who were not delighted about that is I don't think we're going to see something like that happen again anytime soon. Like that was a seriously speculative venture that somehow, if you just acquired enough studios, you would kind of ... economies of scale were going to appear from somewhere. And, yeah. You know, it just... it wasn't really ever clear what the case was, that, and it hasn't worked, and I don't think we're going to see someone trying that move again. You know, then you look at the other end of the market, and the biggest players grouping up. I mean, that is much more likely to continue, and because in a way, some of the most squeezed companies are kind of like the big publishers just below the mega publisher tier, that they're in a really tricky position, that they obviously they have a lot of big established cost bases. They're kind of, they have more and more competition from, I mean, you look at the quality of indie games that are bubbling up now, that's a lot better than what it used to be. They have much worse economics than the console platform holders, who don't have to pay a fee to themselves to distribute on their own platforms. So they're in a really tricky spot. And I think a lot of them will be very happy to sell themselves to Microsoft or whoever else will have them. So barring regulatory hurdles, I think it's quite likely that there will be more deals like that.
My only addition to what Liam has said is that if there were to be any new Embracer, it's going to be Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund kind of looking to make purchases through the year. You know, obviously they've got a limitless pot of cash, so it's up to them as to how to spend it. They've already spent $1.5 billion on an esports company, which is pretty huge money given how much esports makes. So you know, that could be the only possible exception.
I think they said they still have like, I don't think they even number, but they still have like 70, whatever war chest they set out with, they said 75% of it is still available to spend. And I'm like, geez.
Yeah. Well, we are unfortunately out of time. I know we have quite a bit of things to keep going on here, but I just want to thank my colleagues here so, so much. Liam Dean, Dom Tate, Bryant Francis, thank you all very, very much for being here, sharing your thoughts with us. Listeners, stay tuned for part two. We are going to have a part two after the break. Thank you, folks.
Hello, I'm Alyssa McAloon, your friendly GameDeveloper.com publisher. We'll return to your regularly scheduled podcast programming in just a moment, but first, some self-promotion. If you're curious about the data we're discussing this episode, be sure to check out the full State of the Game Industry Report published by our friends at GDC. The full report touches on things we won't have time to discuss here today, like RTO, platform trends, age, gender, and tenure in the game industry, and much, much more. Find it and more information on GDC itself, which is only a few short months away, over on the conference website at gdconf.com. So GDConf. As far as the game developer crew goes, you can find our spoken words right here on the Game Developer Podcast and our written words at gamedeveloper.com, where we cover industry news, developer interviews, and share in-depth write-ups from developers themselves on tricky fixes and flashy features. If you're a developer that wants to share your own triumphs or lessons learned, be sure to check out our blog section over on gamedeveloper.com, where you can share your own stories or learn from those of your peers. We publish those developer-written blogs on games large and small over there, and frequently feature the cream of the crop on our front page and social media. But we'll have all those links for you in the episode description. That'll be it for me, so I'll hand things back over to Danielle and crew. Enjoy.
Everybody, and welcome back to the Game Developer Podcast. I'm Danielle Riendo. I feel like I didn't maybe say that in the first one, but here we are. I'm Danielle Riendo. And in part two here, I have my colleagues Bryant Francis and Holly Green from Game Developer and Beth Elderkin from GDC. We are again speaking about the State of the Game Industry Report, which is, of course, a collaboration among Game Developer, GDC, and Omdia, which we talked about in part one. So folks, if you just want to say hi, introduce yourselves, go for it.
Hi, I'm Beth Elderkin. As mentioned, I'm the content marketing manager for the Game Developers Conference. I've been with GDC for a few years now, and this is my second year as project lead for State of the Game Industry, my third year on it altogether. And as far as games right now, I have a little bit of an embarrassing, not so embarrassing factoid. I am nearing 300 hours on Baldur's Gate 3.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if that's a point of pride or of shame. Pride. It's a little combination of both, but yes, that's what's going on with me right now.
Amazing. Holly, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Holly Green. I'm our community editorial coordinator. I handle our blogs and our developer insight section. I am not playing Baldur's Gate 3. I am playing Power Wash Simulator right now. Excellent. That's about it.
Excellent. Well, cleaning up the introductions, Bryant.
Nice transition. Hi, once again, I'm senior editor Bryant Francis at GameDeveloper.com. Those who listened to the first half of the podcast may have heard me say I'm playing Against the Storm. Guess what? I'm still playing it. We had a lunch break between the two ends of recording the podcast. I played some of it then. I was told I needed to list another game. I'm rebelling against that. I am still playing Against the Storm.
I guess I'm rebelling as well. I'm still playing Into the Breach. I got a 4-island victory with the Zenith Guard, on the unfair difficulty on my lunch break. So I just throwing that out there as well. 6 years and still going strong, baby, on this game. Well, aside from games, we talk about games a lot here, of course, but today we're talking, of course, about the State of the Game Industry Report. And Beth, I wanted to start with you today. I wanted to start with your experiences here. On being a project lead for something like this, this is a massive undertaking. It's a large report. It's about 3,000 game developers that are surveyed. And I just want to hear a little bit about your experiences here, sort of maybe the early stages of it coming together, kind of figuring out, okay, what topics do we go from year to year? What, how do we change the questions? What was the experience like this year in putting this together?
Absolutely. So every year has been a little bit different. Like I said, my first year was a couple years ago. I was 6 months into this position. And the former publisher, Chris Graft, came to me and was like, hey, do you want to help me with this project? And by help, essentially, man, I was thrown into the deep end. And I had to, I had to sink or swim. And hopefully I swam, because the next year after Chris Graft moved on to greener pastures, I was kind of shuffled into the position. And It's been an amazing process getting to be a part of this survey and report, because I have such a deep love for the game industry and I get to look at what everyone is concerned about personally and professionally, not just the games they're making and the platforms that they do, but also how they feel about the industry and, you know, what is happening in terms of representation, what is happening in terms of the business of games, because it's such a huge industry. And so, you know, every year, in this year in particular, you know, I meet with the game developer team along with folks from GDC, and we also met with folks from Omdia, which was great. And we just looked and we're like, what are the big themes from this year? What are the big topics that are resonating with people? And what are the ones we think will be resonating with people over the course of the next year? Because we start this process, let's say for 2024 survey, we started it back in, I'd say, May or June of 2023. Mm-hmm. This takes a very long time. So we also have to be proactive in what conversations that are starting to happen. That's really what happened with layoffs. Even when we did the survey, we had not hit the storm. The storm has since come and grown, and it's become a huge, bigger conversation. When we first started, we thought it was going to be all generative AI. And then by the time SOTY came around, it's a little different.
Yeah, absolutely. I do actually, one of the things we did chat about layoffs in the earlier segment there, I do want to hit on generative AI as one of our sort of main topics here as well. It was one of the big ones this year, was something that I think everybody was sort of waiting with bated breath to see how things would turn out. Can you talk a little bit about what that looked like? And I know, Bryant, you also had some thoughts here about that section of the survey.
Well, I can start a bit about generative AI. As we were looking through, it sort of felt a little bit like a follow-up to the metaverse conversation, to Web3, because that's really honestly where a lot of developers are moving to. But it was different this time. Whereas the conversations around Web3 and the metaverse were, let's say, a little bit more heated, when it comes to generative AI, it's much more mixed, because, you know, there are some very valuable tools that developers are using. And I'll admit, I use some of them in my day-to-day life. I think a lot of people do. But there are also implementations of these tools and intent behind some of these tools that can get into very murky territory, which is where we get a much bigger conversation than I argue we would have had in previous years around metaverse and Web3, even though we are still having those conversations. Yeah. Generative AI has really kicked it up a notch.
Yeah.
I suppose I can. This is where I would slide in, John Woo style. I think one of the most notable statistics on this topic is that the Web3, like you said, Beth, the Web3 and Metaverse questions we asked in the past, the answers were very polarizing. They were very like, you're either in this camp or you're not. They also sort of indicated that like a few developers were thinking very, very much about them. Excellent grammar. They were thinking a lot about them, and most of them were very, if you weren't thinking about it, you were opposed to it. The raw generative AI data, like sorting out positive impact, mixed impact, negative impact that devs think it'll have on the industry, this kind of like sort of positive, mostly mixed, like sort of negative, then people kind of going, don't know, nothing. Like that's kind of like healthy in a way. That's kind of everyone like trying to keep a clear head and like be honest with each other. And I think it represents something positive in that sense, that like people are coming to this question in good faith, no matter who you're talking to. Well, okay, let's be honest. You know, some people are going to both be either unreasonable or grifters. Like that'll happen. But a lot of people,
two sides, you know.
Inside you, there are two wolves. So I think there's something in that end of the survey that I think reflects. It reflects like good faith and a desire to get this right. And I obviously, there's a lot of ways it can go wrong. Maybe we'll discuss some of them here, but like that's my takeaway from the survey. Holly, I would like to ask you, as one of like kind of out of all the people on our team, you've been writing for games for such a long time, you've seen a lot of fads and industry waves come and go. So, how does the AI stuff feel against the other moments you've written about in the past?
I think about the same as almost any trend that seems to come and go. It's very interesting that you say that, Brian. I really appreciate you bringing up the history here because, I mean, we have seen a lot of stuff like loom up over the years that's been like, this is going to be the big thing. It's going to change everything. You know, there's been a lot of hand-wringing and, you know, catastrophizing. We had that about, you know, Farmville back in the day. We had that about mobile games. We've been through that with so many things. And it's really interesting being a part of this team because sometimes you get a window into how fast those trends can really come and go. Now, there was something that was said by, I believe, Alyssa a couple of years ago about something else. It might have been blockchain or Web3, but essentially it was that, you know, with all these things, there's this huge ruckus and there's a big stink at first. And then once that dies down, whatever technology it is at that moment, it finds its practical applications within the industry. Those get applied quietly, and then something more practical gets built from there. In terms of generative AI, the sentiment that I'm seeing that when we get a temperature check on this is that it's not the AI that people are opposed to. They're opposed to theft, and they're opposed to AI being used to reduce or eliminate jobs. I see, you know, the sentiment is that this isn't going away. But if it's got to be here, let's use it to improve our quality of life as creators and as artists. You know, I personally balked initially at some folks, you know, on Twitter or other places are saying kind of like, you know, no artist should have to do something like, you know, spend all these hours rendering a ladder or a box. And I don't 100% fully agree with that in the sense that, you know, there's something to be said for cohesive art styles and every little bit of an environment could be, you know, part of reinforcing a visual theme. That said, as a writer myself, I use things like Grammarly a lot because as an editor, I don't think that the majority of my time should be spent, you know, quibbling over the use of of or on or it or they, you know, like those are things that can be picked up very easily by AI and improve my quality of life on the day to day without eliminating a job. Because let's face it, the editor isn't getting another editor, right? I need that help and it improves my quality of life. So I think we will continue to find these practical applications. There, obviously there's a lot of negativity around it. And I think sometimes that will induce some hesitancy, but that is much needed in an industry where people are very eager to embrace the next big new thing and hop on that bandwagon. So yeah, thank you for asking. That's where I sit with it.
Before we wander into other directions on this topic or other topics from State of the Industry, I wanted to grab a quote from one of the quick quotes we had from the survey itself. This one person whose identity and gender I do not know, wrote down, AI data sets are being created from creative professionals who didn't consent to their work being used to train AI. The people who make and maintain the tools make it difficult or impossible to remove your work or avoid having your work collected in the first place. They also brought up the rights, sort of the scraping of, you know, recently deceased artists, performers, you know, where like it's easy to now feed that in. So if you want, you know, you're like I'm trying to think of a performer that I could, I don't know, bless Kevin Conroy, like the wonderful Kevin Conroy who gave us Batman. Like, obviously his family members are going to do their best to protect his legacy, but if you just scraped all those hours of Batman, especially his voice work in the video games, like a person with ill intent could scrape all that, get it there, and then modify it maybe just enough for legal distinction to make their, hopefully WB wouldn't do that for a Batman game, but maybe someone would do it for like their knockoff superhero parody game. So that's like, when we talk about what people are worried about with theft and the lack of consent over its use, it's real and it's right there, you know?
Yeah, I'll just say anecdotally, I'm a sort of beginner artist. I'm learning art right now. I'm in a lot of art communities and it is vehemently, most of the folks I'm around are very, very, very vehemently sort of against, for reasons. I think there is a real... The original sin sort of concept here that you're bringing up, Bryant, I think is incredibly valid and consent, as well as, you know, folks are just generally quite afraid in the current environment regarding layoffs, which we did touch on a little bit before as well. But I think there is a way here, and this is how I've been trying to sort of have a little bit of hope about the industry in a very, very dark time, or a difficult time, a challenging time, let's put it. And that was the sort of conversation and the sort of stats that we saw about unionization in this in the survey. And Beth, I know you said you wanted to actually really sort of tackle this. There was a really, to me, I think, hopeful statistic about younger folks, younger developers supporting unions. So if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Yes, unionization has been a really interesting conversation that has been in the state of the game industry for a few years now. In fact, when I first came into the picture, we were asking about general union support, but we weren't even asking if people were talking about forming unions, if people were forming unions. And that has since been added because that's what's happening in the industry right now. It's no longer just speculation. It's no longer just talk. We're seeing action happen. We see, you know, CWA coming to GDC and telling people about, we have a session at GDC 2024 that is literally called Now is the Time to Form a Union. So the thing that really stood out to me with the unionization survey this year, the data was pretty similar to last year. But this year we were able to look at data segmentation. We were able to break down based on things like gender, how long you've been in the industry, what your job role is. And for the most part with unionization, the numbers were pretty consistent, except when it came to the age of the developers. This was actually the first year we actually asked about age, which I'm very happy we did because we ended up finding out this surprising information, which was younger developers, for example, 18 to 24, were almost 3/4 in favor of unionization. Whereas if you went to the other side of the spectrum, which is, I believe, like 60, 65 older, it was about 1/4. So it's like a 50 percentage point decrease. And what really, I was talking to a few people about what we thought this data could represent because it's such a stark number. And we talked about it as well in our discussions about state of the game industry. And I heard a few people saying that perhaps it was because when you're older, maybe your career priorities change. Maybe a younger developer is going to be more attuned to the idea of unionization because they're coming into the industry and they want that additional protection. But I don't necessarily agree with that. What I think it is, it's a larger, it's developers are part of a larger system of younger people who are more in favor of unionization because they've seen previous generations, you know, post-Reagan being impacted by the lack of representation and how it's impacted their futures and their careers. And so I think overall, we're seeing a movement among younger developers and younger people to create those places of protection. And I think having it in media outlets, having it in Starbucks is, you know, these places where younger people are working is really starting to have an impact. And it's pretty inspiring to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Holly, I know you engage with our community folks so much. And I wanted to see if you had some thoughts there.
You know, so I was the one who handled that section of the survey and was the one who requested the segmentation on there because I was curious to see what does that look like when you divide it up by multiple different demographics. And it was interesting to see how consistent it was until it came to that age gap. And, you know, I think I would just generally attribute that to, you know, I think that's a generational difference that probably plays out in a lot of industries. You know, when you look at the difference in those age groups, who's probably sitting in a better place now in terms of long-term stability, building wealth, healthcare? Whether or not they've been, whether or not they own a home, whether or not they've been able to start a family. Yeah. You know, there is a huge generational divide right now, and it is not limited to our industry. And I think this is just symptomatic of that. I think we are one of the industries most desperately in need of unionization, but this is America. You know, this is, I mean, this is, we all, I mean, who isn't? I mean, who isn't? It's, you know, everyone here within this conversation, you know, right now, we're all like pretty similarly aged. You know, we probably all have parents or grandparents who kind of are maybe from kind of a got mine generation. Not to be too rude, and I apologize, but
my folks are boomers. I get it.
You know, that's climbing up the ladder and pulling it up behind you, you know, as you go. And I think that's a little bit of what the generation coming up behind us is feeling. And honestly, I find their energy extremely inspiring because, you know, that's what happens when you push a group of people to the point where they don't have a lot to lose. And so if this trend continues, I only see that gap widening further.
Brian, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I can skate over some ones. Some other fun things from this data point are narrative designers are most likely to be in favor of unionization. I assume that's writers and narrative designers because I know my people. We can get finicky about that.
yes.
While those working in business and finance were least likely to support, and I think that's very funny, just like on its face, like, I've thrown the business and finance people under the bus today twice, so I got to be careful. But the only other, I think I want to raise one point about the data itself real quick, which is that there might be kind of a survivorship bias here, which is if you made it this far in the game industry, you don't actually think you need a union because you might be, if you're in your 50s or 60s and looking at a, you know, shorter career left than like us at our age, you're sitting there going like, man, why make my life like harder like this? Versus, you know, then a lot of people who were in the game industry who, when they were younger, who left earlier, the people who made the exact people who may have thought to themselves like, oh yeah, I could totally use a union. To close out my thoughts on the topic, I think some of the interesting stable year over year stuff also has to do with the slow rate that unions are popping up in the game industry. You know, we had a burst of activity last year with some of the Activision Blizzard unions, the ZeniMax union. It has not been like, you know, this like tidal wave, I guess. It's just more like I don't know what the metaphor is going to be, so I'm going to move on. I think a lot of developers are in search of resources for how to become unions. We've mentioned the CWA at the show. I think there's like a struggle with like, how do we unionize when, you know, not everyone in my team may support it. Not everyone like here may support it. I work for a company. And so like IATSE doesn't quite, you know, fit in here. The film and television workers union like doesn't fit in the same way because we're all staffers. There's a lot of questions there. Some people would love to have them answered. I don't fully have those answers off the top of my head. And that's something that may affect getting that information, getting out there and having people talk to each other, like Beth raised about asking people about it on the survey. You know, those are good things going forward.
Yeah, Beth, just to shout it out one more time, what, do you happen to know the name of the talk that's happening with the CWA? Yes. Look for CWA.
Well, there's a panel with a series of developers and union advocates, and awesome. I believe it's called Now is the Time to Form a Union. And so it's, if it's something that you're curious in, I would definitely recommend checking it out. There'll be a lot of great people there having some very important conversations.
Excellent. Speaking of important conversations, here's my segue going into game engines. I know there was no really good one there. We could say an engine for change. Maybe we'll go with that for unions, but here we go.
Unions are in search of unity, maybe?
Unions are in search of unity, waiting for
the show.
And it's
disgust.
Just unreal out there. Yeah, sorry. I'm so sorry for what I just did there.
anyway. I'm just going to sit here.
You're like, I'm good, wait my turn. I'm good. All right. So engines, game engines. Obviously, in fall of last year, we truly had an interesting time. Brian, I'm going to let you chat about this because you were kind of at the forefront of reporting this, but you had these sort of unity kerfuffle, and there was very tangible evidence that a lot of developers are starting to think about maybe changing their engine if they were working primarily with the Unity game engine. But I'll let you take this one because you were reporting on it.
Yeah. So as first by reported by Game Developer, and I guess I have to say as first reported by yours truly, yes. Unity announced in September that it would begin collecting a quote runtime fee based on the number of times a game was installed. All it took was a few people doing math and looking at the numbers to realize that this could be devastating for games of certain ways. It didn't seem to account for demos, didn't seem to account for free weekends. Like it was a shockingly, like it was a plan that I think they hoped would just go, okay, like most devs only have to pay a few cents on the dollar. We can collect that sweet, sweet engine impact money. And instead it turned into like, wait, what if I make a hit game, you might just take all my money. So it stunk. Like from the minute I have to confess, I saw, you know, when I saw the info for the first time, I was like, oh, people aren't going to like this. But I kind of thought it would be the same backlash as we saw the year before at the time they did a price increase after a summer of bad PR. And this was like, what followed was like nothing else we've ever seen. I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen such backlash at a tool provider like Unity, Unreal, or thought to be these, you know, these like very stable, like sort of the shops that sell the goods, like so that you can go and take the risk on the games, and this helps you reduce the risk. And reducing that stability, like threatening that is maybe the biggest impact than whether or not whatever, you know, because ultimately the runtime fee was removed in favor of like either an engagement fee or a revenue share. And whatever, like, I know plenty of people were satisfied with that change. I know plenty of people will stick with Unity for that change. But the sense of being rattled that I think the whole game industry got, it's, and then Unreal Engine's changes for non-game industry licensors a few weeks later, plus some layoffs. It didn't provoke the same reaction, but I saw a lot of developers talking about how it just left them shaken. Like, both companies displayed instability, and these are companies whose maybe one of the things they sell is stability. I know I'm rambling. I want to quickly share listeners some data in case they haven't read the report themselves. 7% of developers have already considering switching games and engines in the last 12 months, or excuse me, 7% have already switched. 28% have considered switching. About half of them aren't. And then about 16% that said they don't know, they're not sure yet. I don't know what that data means yet, because it's literally year over year. I think according to our partners at Omdia, Godot is the engine that a lot of people are looking at. That might be because it's the engine. If you're used to working with Unity, it's a smoother transition to jump to Godot based on the coding language. A programmer in the chat's going to yell at me for not getting it right. But
C# works with it. So
there we go. So I'm going to do a shock call here, which is I don't think Godot is going to surge ahead and overtake Unity. I think there's an interesting thing happening where this can be a moment where game developers decentralize a little, and that Unity and Unreal lose a bit of their pillar status. And that means open source engines, rolling your own engines, working together on engines. I don't know what the business and legal impacts of making all that happen are, but I think if you're going, oh, well, Unity's out, time for an upstart to take their place, I don't think that's what's coming down the pipe.
Yeah, Holly, I know you've published a few blogs sort of that week, sort of talking about folks who are just here's some alternatives, here's some things you can do, here's kind of what's going on. Just wanted to get your take on sort of what developers were kind of saying during the month or so, really, when the sentiment was as high as it was. yeah, there was some rage. There was some rage.
Emotions.
Yeah. Emotions were happening.
Thoughts, feelings, reactions.
So I want to draw this parallel, and I think a lot of people will kind of be feeling this right now. It's interesting that as this thing with Unity blew up at the end of the year, it really mirrored how many people are likely feeling right now about Twitter as, you know, as these primary platforms where I've built so much of my career, and now this is very suddenly being taken away from me, and I don't know where to go. So I feel like what's kind of been in the air with Unity and Godot is the same thing we've been seeing with Twitter versus, you know, Blue Sky, Mastodon, Threads, et cetera. It's, we haven't built a community and support system elsewhere, and this is not going to stop happening. So we better start working on that now. And so the sentiment I'm seeing is, you know, we need to be responsible for the longevity of our own work. You know, we need to take more matters in our own hands to make sure that a rug can't be pulled out from us and we don't have other options. So I see a little bit of that happening. People reaching out saying, here's some resources, here's some places where we can get started. Here's a bunch of open source engines, and maybe it's not perfect for this yet, but maybe we can start suggesting these improvements. The conversation isn't as loud as it was a couple months ago, to be sure. But at the same time, I think people are starting to weigh their options and looking at how do we build something outside of this one thing so that we do not get caught in this tough spot again, where we're just essentially cornered by our own lack of options. So
I believe, Holly, under your purview, we published that one wonderful blog where a developer talked about, I forget the developer and I forget the game, but they talked about publishing, or inside of a weekend, they talked about porting their game from Unity to Godot and how it just took a couple days. And that was really a signifier from the community that, something shook there, that someone could so easily make the jump and you feel the earth shake below you.
Go ahead. It's fine.
Oh no, I just think a lot of people are feeling that insecurity right now in multiple parts of this industry and other creative mediums as well. Just that the systems that we've built up and have established in place, as imperfect as they are, can also be taken away very, very, very quickly. And then what are we left with? And so I think we're in a moment of contemplation about that right now. And sorry for interrupting you, Beth. Continue.
Oh, by all means. It's actually interesting because what we're talking about with Twitter and with game engines is really kind of reflective of an overall theme that I noticed, that we noticed in State of the Game Industry this year, which was a feeling of frustration and in some cases borderline worries of helplessness.
Yeah.
You know, we had the line in there that it's been a challenging year, which is really an understatement of the century. It's been a hard year. But with things like social media, with, you know, Twitter, we asked people about, you know, what their social media options are. And people are still using Twitter X, but they don't want to. With sustainability, people largely felt, well, these big companies that are doing, you know, I'm doing my part, but there's bigger problems than me. How can I fix those? With DEI, it's, you know, companies made all these promises and now we're seeing all these layoffs that are disproportionately affecting women and people of color. So there is this overall theme in State of the Game Industry this year where we were having all this forward momentum and now there's some backtracking. And while some would call it course correction, others would call it just a bad situation and one that we're not quite sure how to move forward from. So that's really what I'm curious to see in State of the Game Industry 2025 is, do we move forward or are we going to continue feeling stagnated? And that's an interesting question that I'm interested in exploring next time around.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually how I wanted to steer the conversation back is almost kind of, I know you have a bit of a, you know, a break from State of the Industry because now it's GDC happening,
yes.
But then you're going to be getting right back into State of the Game Industry. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that of are you even thinking about next year yet? Are you thinking about, oh my goodness, how can some of these questions go? Obviously, we're going to have a year, things are going to happen, but we've already had quite a year, 3 weeks into the year already. So,
well, yeah. I think a couple of things that will be happening over the next few months are, one, going to GDC, seeing what conversations are happening there, because that really does inform what, you know, what conversations we're having about the industry. And also, you know, we have reflection afterward. We talk about what worked about State of the Game Industry, what needs to be improved on, because there's always things to grow and improve. And there's always ways that we can get better. And so really after that, it's seeing where the conversations are going. I got to be honest, I haven't really thought much about it yet, just because sure. I'm still in 2024 mode. And
but how dare you? Yeah.
I am right. Interested to see what happens in 2025, and I will be looking to Game Developer and to your coverage to see where we go in the future.
Excellent. Unless there are other thoughts, that feels like a really good place to wrap up on State of the Industry 2024. Anybody have any other thoughts? Or
I might as well take the invitation. Sorry. I gave a thumbs up and then there was dangling there. It's going to be a tough year. It's already a tough year. The layoffs get ripped like after the new year. Everyone just was like, all right, time to close up. Time go away. It's after the holidays. Like, that's a blithe. I have to be careful because that was a blasé way of describing it. And this is not a blasé thing. So, it's going to be a tough year. We need to sort of stare that in the face and not act like, okay, phew, like the big one's over. It's Wednesday. Like clearly they're all done by now. It's like, no, this year is going to be a pounding on our morale in that sense. And I think all I can urge listeners to do on two fronts is to one, you know, that frustration is all valid and it's good not to let it turn to despair. And two, like all the reasons to be frustrated that we've discussed in the survey are also reasons to be hopeful. You all want things to be better in video games. You all want to make great video games. You all don't want to be at the mercy of people who are kind of just a little more cynical about this whole affair. You don't want to be abused and exploited by in different angles. And I think that's pretty good. That makes me hopeful that like that's what the survey indicates, and I hope that's what we bring into the year is let frustration be one thing and not the other.
And just to add to that, Brian, I mean that's really why State of the Game Industry exists. Is, you know, we have thousands of developers, you know, tens of thousands of developers around the world, and we want to make sure that their voices are being heard by, you know, not only you know, just the game developer community, but especially the people who are making those decisions. And, you know, having people's voices and their perspectives in there, you know, gives quantitative and qualitative data to the people who are making those choices. And so we just, you know, I want to thank everybody who participated. If you didn't participate this year, I understand. I highly recommend doing so next year, because the more voices, the better.
Absolutely. Thank you so, so much, Beth, for being here on the podcast, everyone. Beth Elderkin from GDC, my colleagues, Holly Green and Bryant Francis from Game Developer. Thank you all so, so much for listening. And be sure to check out more of our coverage on gamedeveloper.com.